Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The federal government is looking at how to make a special bad bank to deal with the financial crisis. Let's listen in.
Attorney General.
Eric, Tim here. Geithner, yeah. Anyway, we've got a problem.
I know. The economy's tanking.
No. It's a little more specific than that.
Okay, sure.
Well, we've got this idea to make this bad bank.
Right.
Yeah, to hold all the really toxic, worthless assets in one awful financial institution.
You need to make a bad bank.
Right.
Well, what's the problem? Seems like there are any number of bad banks out there. Lots of bad bankers buy up toxic assets, lose people's money, that sort of thing.
Eric, leave the Treasury Department stuff to me, okay? You don't understand. Those people are all spoken for. They're employed.
For now.
Yeah, but we need this done yesterday.
Right.
The big man.
I see a problem.
Uh-huh.
Well, I bet you could get Thane.
Nah, too hot to handle. We need someone with experience for years in taking billions and billions and rendering them worthless.
Now I see why you're calling me.
Understand?
That's big.
Uh-huh.
But he's bad.
Look, I think we have to spring Madoff, and you've got some experience with this sort of thing.
You mean the Mark Rich thing?
Bingo.
You want a bad bank? Madoff's your man.
You see my point.
Let me make a couple of calls, okay?
Mr. Attorney General, I thank you. And the nation thanks you. You are the baddest. Can I say that?
You're a little over the line there, Tim.
I am a banker. Sorry.
Oh, we're bad. To deal with a really bad crisis, you need a really bad bank. We're not kidding. We're The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, January 30th. Adora Udoji is away. We're going to talk about bad banks, and we've got the best real-life spy story from our partners at the New York Times. But first, the headlines. Until the very end of his time as Illinois Governor, Rod Blagojevich said he's not a crook.
You haven't proved a crime, and you can't because it hadn't happened. You haven't given me a chance to disprove a crime. But so far, a crime has not been proven here in this impeachment proceeding.
Nevertheless, 59 to zip, and he's kicked out. Blagojevich didn't stay to hear the vote. Staying in the political world, there's a vote this morning. The Republican National Committee is going to vote this morning, possibly to replace its chairman. Five men, including the current chairman, are fighting to head the GOP. And Femi Oke is here with some more top headlines. What else is going on, Femi?
Good morning, all. 4 million uninsured children could soon get some health coverage. Last night, the Senate passed a bill to give government-sponsored insurance to 4 million uninsured kids, and the bill goes to the House next. The latest GDP numbers come out at the bottom of this hour. Forecasters predict that they'll show the U.S. economy shrinking at a level not seen in more than a quarter century.
Ouch. And those numbers are factored into the futures trading this morning. Looks like a down opening on Wall Street, but the S&P starts trading at 8:45. It lost a 3.3% yesterday. Treasury, as we mentioned, maybe to a fault, is creating a bad bank that would buy up all the toxic debt and mortgage securities from the regular banks. I mean, would the ATMs, like, rip us off? How would that work? We want to know, what should we call this bank?
The worst national bank.
That's good. Tell us your suggestions at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with two guests, one of whom is very familiar to all of you, I'm sure. Stephen Dubner joins us, Takeaway contributor, co-author of the Freakonomics book and blog. And since we're talking about bad banks this morning, I thought it was just great to bring in someone who knows all about Freakonomics. I mean, I don't know specifically if bad banks would qualify, but good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. My bank Citibank is terrible, if that helps.
If that helps, thank you. Also, Jane Sassine, Washington Bureau Chief for Businessweek Magazine, is here in the studio. Jane, thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
So let's take apart this idea that has been floating around for a while, that was actually explicitly talked about by Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. The Obama administration is considering the creation of some sort of separate institution, a so-called bad bank, to put all these bad assets we've heard about, mortgage-backed securities, credit default swaps, all kinds of things that they can't really price, stick them in one bank. And I can joke about this forever. I mean, I can imagine a bad bank where you go in and the money, like, comes out of your wallet, the ATMs rip you off as opposed to give you your money. But this is a really serious idea. Jane, explain.
Yeah, absolutely. The concern is all these assets are weighing down the banking system, and that's what's stopping lending. You know, as everybody's talking about, there's no lending going on. It's really hard to get a mortgage. It's really hard for businesses to get new loans and whatnot. And the reason is all these bad assets are keeping the banks from lending. And so in order to get that going and get the economy restarted and avoid enormous bank failures and, you know, the threat of a depression, they feel they have to move those off the banks and recapitalize them so that they can start, you know, putting money out into the economy again. Nobody really knows if it'll work, but that's the model they used, like in the SNL crisis earlier, right. The RTC model. That's the model they're basing it on.
Stephen, does this feel to you like a rhetorical flourish in some sense, like Al Gore's lockbox, remember the 2000 campaign, or something that sort of says something that feels makes us feel better? But we're talking about billions of dollars here. I wonder if it makes people feel better,
well,
really.
Well, look, I know nothing about actual banking. So
Let's stipulate that at the top.
All right. I'm listening to Jane to try to
Neither
figure out.
Neither do many bankers at the moment,
well,
apparently.
Well, so I'm, as a
You're
person,
hired, Stephen.
As a layperson, I try to figure out what I do think is significant about it is since that toxicity remains the question mark that drives the bad psychology that's driving the market, then if you can isolate the toxicity in some way, then psychologically at least, the market and, you know, the laity may react well. That strikes me as the biggest asset to it. But I wanted to know, I just read something, I may be wrong on this. Did UBS try this kind of internally about a year ago to take within itself and isolate those toxic assets and deal with it? And
they may have. I'm not familiar with UBS specifically. But the problem is even if a bank tried to do that individually, it wouldn't work because the problem is a bank has a certain amount of capital and they can lend against that. So if a bank had $1 million in capital, they could lend out 10 times more than that. And these bad assets have really eroded their capital base. So in that example, if they had all these lousy assets, the capital of $1 million suddenly would become 500,000, and that limits how much they can lend. So as long as it's in the same institution, that's what's limiting lending right now.
I mean, the definition of a bank is your capital is put up against your liabilities.
Exactly.
And these toxic assets are liabilities. Explain how it actually would work. Would some paper be then given to some federal institution called the Bank of America of nastiness, and what would happen? Would that bank try to sell them to people? Would it? What would it do?
Yeah, essentially, the government would have to set up a complete separate institution, and it would be on a size and a scale of something like vastly larger than the RTC. We've never actually seen it, and that's part of what's taking so long to figure this out is how exactly would you do it?
And would the federal government have to match the? So say it takes $1 trillion worth of worthless stuff. Does that mean that $1 trillion worth of taxpayer money has to go in there to back it?
Well, they would actually – what they're talking about doing is taking something like $100 billion of the, you know, the Treasury, the TARP funds, borrowing from the Fed or raising bonds. So they would have used leverage to take it up to $1 trillion, go out and buy $1 trillion of these assets off the bad banks. So basically they'd give the current banks cash for these bad assets. So that would replenish their capital, which would allow them to lend again. Right now they're talking about it needing up to $2 trillion to do this,
$2 trillion.
To remove these assets.
Yeah. What are the risks on the upside? On the downside, if it turns out that the assets are worth even less than we think, then the downside is pretty obvious. The taxpayers will pay. On the upside, now I've read one objection is that if the assets turn out to be worth more, then the banks who surrendered them suffer. I don't follow that. Can you explain? Is that true?
They just feel bad. They don't suffer. Yeah.
Well, there is – if you look back at the RTC, they actually made a lot more money.
That's
off
the Resolution
of
Trust Corporation that dissolved the worthless assets from the savings and loan crisis.
And they went in, the government went in, as all the banks failed then, took over all these failed real estate loans. And because the government could hold them over time and manage the assets like an asset manager, eventually they got a lot more money back for those assets. And one of the theories—
But let me just stop you there. What does it mean to manage a troubled asset? Does it mean you're like calling people up to pay me? I mean, what does managing an asset that is essentially worthless actually mean in practice?
Well, the question is, are these assets actually essentially worthless?
Right.
Because if you look at these pools of mortgage securities, right. say there's 100 mortgages in a pool, maybe 10% of those people are going to foreclose, people can't pay those, and they're bad.
The other ones they're paying
90% they're paying on,
right.
but the value that there has come down so much because nobody knows kind of which 10% is right.
Right.
So over time, if the government came in and brought in smart people to do this, in theory, 90% of those mortgages would still be good eventually. So if they hold them over 5 or 10 or the life of the mortgage, the value will come back, and the government will actually make a lot of money back. So that's the idea.
So one metaphor here is maybe archaeology, that the smart people would come in and actually figure out in all of the numbers and the codes and the account numbers who's behind each of these mortgages,
exactly.
figure out whether they're paying
yeah.
or not, and then actually make a value for this sort of thing and either sell it again or just sell the individual mortgages,
exactly.
right?
Exactly.
That's right.
Now or pull them back together because they've all been sliced and diced into whole bunches of little pieces, and that's part of the problem. They're in these pools and they're all little bits and pieces, but if the government controlled them all, in theory, over time, they could pull them back together and do that.
Well, not only that, because the government, unlike a bank, has a lot of advantages over a bank, right? It's a market maker in a way that the bank is not, which would make Bernie Madoff the perfect guy.
Yeah.
But
I
also—
can we get him? I don't know if we can get him.
But also—
He's free, I think.
They're also a lawmaker, right? So is it—
Well, because they can do these sorts of things in a way that the private sector can't right now. The other advantage is that they can borrow money at a lot cheaper, so they don't need as much of a return. You know, again, they don't necessarily need a return at all, whereas a private investor to go in and do this right now is going to need, you know, a 10 or 15% return to take the risks involved, whereas the government, essentially the taxpayer, is taking a big risk but doesn't need to get a 15% return in order to do this.
Or maybe does, because we've been promised as taxpayers that these assets are going to be worth something. Barney Frank on this program said that the government may benefit from holding equity in this nasty stuff. Let's talk for a moment about bank nationalization, which is the other scenario that's been talked about. Is this an alternative to nationalization, or is it something we would do in addition to nationalization, or are they unrelated?
I think it's in addition. I think they're going to end up having to do some of both. They would like to avoid nationalization because the broader consequences of that are even larger. There's a lot of fear that if you ended up with the government owning the banks, there'd be a lot of political pressure to lend money to failing companies and the types of scenarios you can imagine are not good. That said, they do want to get some upside for it. If the government takes all this risk on, they want the taxpayer to benefit. So, one way of doing that is giving the taxpayer equity in these banks and, being a shareholder and benefiting. So there are going to be some combination. The really failed banks that for some reason they feel they have to keep alive could end up being nationalized, essentially like Fannie and Freddie at this point. I mean, they're going to have to let a lot of banks go, too. If they're insolvent, they're going to have to make some very hard decisions and let them go.
Is this feeling like Freakonomics to you a little bit?
I want to come up with the right name for this bank.
But maybe. Yes.
What about the last National Bank of America?
Last National, but that's good. National, right. All right, one last question here before we go, and it might be the most complicated, which is typical of me. If the Chinese are financing the debt that's going to support this institution, In my world on planet Earth, there's collateral that goes up to secure loans. Okay, if the Chinese lend, what's the collateral? Is it like my house? Is it like my laptop computer? Is it my kids? Is it like the school down the street? Is it the Capitol building?
That's actually a very good question. I think it's their faith that the U.S. government will continue, if they pour out all these bonds, that the government will continue to pay it back.
So
will they actually come and reclaim the Empire State Building? I don't know.
We might actually sell the Brooklyn Bridge to someone. And
we might for a heck of a lot more than 5 beads.
That's great. Jane Sassine, thank you so much for coming into the studio. Washington Bureau Chief for Business Week Magazine, talking about the bad banks. And Stephen Dubner, stick with us. Takeaway contributor and co-author of the Freakonomics book and blog.
Freakonomics.
That's right. Here's a little happy news, at least if you're ExxonMobil. They shattered the U.S. record with a $45.2 billion annual profit. And that's despite the oil price plunging at the end of 2008. ExxonMobil with a record quarterly profit of $45.2 billion. We're also waiting for GDP numbers coming out. They're not going to be as happy, but stay tuned for that.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So as we've been discussing, the Treasury is considering making a bad bank that would purchase toxic debt from all the regular private sector banks. We want to know, what should we call this bank? Stephen Dubner had a suggestion, Last National Bank. Some banks are named after their founders. We could try Geithner, Paulson Mistrust, or Paulson National. Or, you know, tell us your ideas at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Stephen Dubner, when did the 20th century end? Do you know?
A couple hours ago?
No. I say the 20th century ended 30 years ago when the Islamic Revolution brought Ayatollah Khomeini to power. It transformed us here in America, and I wonder if you agree with me. The bad guys in America up until that point were Cold War bad guys, Russian bad guys, Joe Stalin, Khrushchev, Gromyko, you know, those kind of folks. Khomeini became the ultimate bad guy 30 years ago after the Islamic Revolution.
Yeah, the old bad guys remind me a little bit when you read about the Revolutionary War and how the Americans won, because the redcoats just stood up in a line of redcoats and fired at you, so you knew where to find them. This is a little bit different.
Yeah, well, in some ways, we were the redcoats to the Islamic revolutionaries who have plagued us ever since and have been the sort of mythological bad guys in our minds. And joining us to talk about the significance of this 30-year anniversary, which is getting underway in Iran, is John Lyne of the BBC. He joins us from Tehran. John, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So what is, you know, the significance of the Islamic Revolution in Iran is one thing, but it certainly has become a narrative for geopolitics from the moment Ayatollah Khomeini stepped off that plane from Paris to the adoring crowds in Iran. Would you say that that narrative is still continuing?
I think it's interesting you mentioned the red coats, not a sensitive subject at all with the British, because I think if you... The longer I've been here, the more I really feel that the Islamic Revolution was really Iran's war of independence. And that is really why it survives so strongly now, despite the many problems this country faces. People, like wars of independence around the world, it's such a confused tangle of emotions, but there's so much pride in there. People felt they were humiliated, they were ruled by a Shah. Well, they criticized the Shah for his excesses, he had palaces and so forth, but really what they really disliked was they felt, rightly or wrongly, that he was being manipulated by the United States in particular. Ever since, and everybody will still mention to you an event, 55 years ago, the 1953 coup in which the CIA and Britain helped unseat the elected Prime Minister Mossadegh. So above all, it's been a national pride thing. And if you look around... wars of independence around the world. Look around Africa, look around elsewhere in the world about wars of independence, and you'll see that the system of government that follows isn't always, frankly, as efficient as the one that preceded it, even under colonial times.
No, and certainly not as... I mean, you know, to carry the revolutionary model forward, Iran maintained its sort of sense that we are surrounded by enemies. I mean, the hostage situation followed the sense that, you know, the CIA is everywhere was something that assisted the Khomeini government in maintaining its credibility inside Iran. But that's really settled down in the 30 years since.
Well, in a way it has, of course. I mean, you'll still hear death to America chanted every week. Death to America, death to Israel. By the hostage taking, by the U.S. embassy siege, Iran did two things. It was a really crucial event, as crucial as the revolution, because it determined the way it turned out, which was that the hardliners took control. And since then, really, this country hasn't been a proper democracy, although it hasn't been. There is some democracy here. And at the same time, it really guaranteed the enmity of the United States and therefore isolation for Iran from the West.
Well, let's
that's been the narrative ever since.
Right. Well, let's talk about what people are feeling there in Iran. I mean, is the legacy for Iranians, aside from this national pride that you talk about, I mean, do they feel as though they began what has ended up being things like suicide bombers, the sort of martyrdom impulse that is so prevalent in certain areas of the Islamic world? Do Iranians believe that that's a heroic consequence of the revolution, or are they trying to distance themselves from those sorts of things?
Well, we always got to be careful here about the Iranian government and the Iranian people.
Right.
The Iranian people, I think, really wouldn't have much of a view on that. They certainly wouldn't understand that Iran maybe, in some extent, is responsible for, well, you could say, to some extent, really sparked off the whole kind of battle between Islam and the West, to some extent. And that includes helping the spread of suicide bombing via Hezbollah into Lebanon. So the government, I don't think, would admit its part in that, but quietly would be quite rather pleased that Iran continues its defiance of the West and its defiance of America.
John, what is the split between the feeling between the people and the government of Iran toward the election of Obama? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I think the government itself is kind of confused about it. President Bush was such a kind of certainty for them. They knew they hated him, and they were pretty sure that a lot of the rest of the world, frankly, joined them in that. So that made life pretty easy for them. Now, President Obama, they're very confused about it. They were very slow to respond to his initial advances. And then President Ahmadinejad, having sent him a message of congratulations, a unique event in the history of the Islamic Republic, then responded to his offer the other day of the hand of friendship, or whatever the exact words were, by a speech in which he said, yes, if there's real change, we welcome it. But at the same time, it was one of the strongest anti-American speeches I've ever heard him make, just listing tens and tens of things for which they blame America, from the 1953 coup to support for some, just an almost endless list of grievances. People, in general, I think they're rather intrigued. Certainly, obviously, the kind of more westernized elite are very intrigued. It's always difficult to get a complete picture of Iran. It's a country, a very varied country, a lot of people in villages who are poorer. But even they, I think, will be very interested and be interested to see. But don't forget that there's this great legacy of bitterness from the Bush administration. I know things are seen differently either side of the Atlantic, but for example, the unquestioning American support for Israel against the Palestinians in Gaza recently is just seen by almost everybody here, pro or anti-government. I'm just very, very bitter about that.
Well, the window on Iran will open a bit as we observe some of the celebrations that will take place over the next months or so. This 30th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution is starting to be celebrated. I'd like to thank our guest, BBC correspondent John Lyne, who spoke with us from Tehran in an interview conducted earlier this morning. Fascinating stuff. And Femi Okeh has the headlines.
At 29 minutes past the hour, the House plans to take up children's health insurance next week. The Senate passed a bill yesterday extending health care to 4 million uninsured children. Former President Bush twice vetoed similar bills. A military judge says that a case against one detainee at Guantanamo Bay should go on. That's despite a request by President Obama to stop all trials there for 120 days. The case involves a man accused of planning the 2000 attack on the USS Cole in Yemen. An offshore oil drilling project in California is dead. A state panel rejected the proposal to expand drilling off the coast of Santa Barbara. Republicans are looking for a new leader to head the party. There are five candidates left for the next party chair, including the current chairman, Mike Duncan. That's a look at news making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Big rally in the futures. All of a sudden, the fourth quarter GDP in the U.S. Just announced from the government is 3.8% down. That's a decline, but still it was a decline less than expected, and so the Dow Jones futures have gone from being very negative to very positive. That rally will probably continue. The Treasury is considering making a bad bank that would purchase the toxic debt from regular banks. We've been talking about it all morning. We want to know, what should we call this bank?
This is Frank from New Rochelle, New York. I think we should call it the Dank Rank Bank that Stank.
Thanks, Frank. Tell us your ideas at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Ooh, Freakonomics.
On Sunday, the powerhouse Pittsburgh Steelers face off against the Arizona Cardinals in Super Bowl 43. What does that have to do with Freakonomics? Well, the Cardinals are the underdog, and we talked about them yesterday, but we're joined now by our friend and takeaway contributor, Stephen Dubners, who's with us this morning. He's here to talk about the Steelers because he's one of the world's biggest Steeler fans, co-author of the Freakonomics book and blog. So, Dubner, you got 10 reasons to like the Pittsburgh Steelers. Number one, they're the huge favorite, right?
For a lot of people, that's probably a reason not to like them. I'm actually – so for the casual fan who's trying to make up their mind, you know, the Super Bowl's kind of become the new national New Year's holiday almost. It really is this day where everybody coalesces and watches. The favorite's, you know, usually the one you want to root against. I'm making the argument that the Steelers, despite being the favorite, are the kind of team that you want sports teams to be. In fact, they're the kind of institution that if the government were a little bit more like them, well, you wouldn't have much material for a radio show, frankly. They've got a lot of integrity and just kind of old-fashioned class and common sense. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons to like them. So I'm not going to give you – on the blog I wrote 10. I could come up with 100 easily. I'm a little bit of a lunatic on the subject, so I don't want to go overboard.
Okay, well, let's steer clear of lunacy. Let's keep it grounded in statistics and science and the kinds of things that have made you famous as our Freakonomics buddy. Why should I like the Pittsburgh Steelers?
Well, here's a good reason.
Logically.
Football wasn't quite invented in Pittsburgh. Football itself wasn't quite invented in Pittsburgh. It was pretty close. It really grew up there. Okay, so it was a sport that got its roots there. And if you look at the Hall of Fame, or if you look at just a list of any list of great players in football, especially quarterbacks, so many of them came out of Pittsburgh and Western Pennsylvania. John Unitas, Joe Namath, on and on and on.
Terry Bradshaw.
No,
he didn't come out of there.
He played there. He came out of Louisiana. But the interesting thing about Pittsburgh and football is that it really means something there in a way that it doesn't mean in many other parts of the country. Back when they were making a lot of steel, all the area steel mills and coal operations, they had their own football teams. Mm-hmm. It was part of the fabric of the community. And the team has been owned by the same family since its inception, and therefore it runs on this kind of different mode than most other professional sports teams.
Do you remember that movie, The Deer Hunter?
Vaguely.
The opening of The Deer Hunter is all this Pittsburgh kind of rural, right outside of Pittsburgh, steel mill kind of world. They're all wearing Steelers hats.
Yeah, well, that's true. Well, you know, it's interesting. Dan Rooney, the chairman of the Steelers, is a lifelong Republican. He, however, went to the mat for Obama this year, starting in the primaries against Hillary, and he campaigned vigorously. So if you like Obama, then you have reason to root for the Steelers.
Because, Obama likes the Steelers, he says.
You know, that's
he
a little
favors them.
That, not surprising, because they're a very appealing team. They have appealing players, coaches, history, and so on. But he should know that the Arizona Cardinals actually began life as the Chicago Cardinals. So he really, I hate to say it, he really should be rooting for the Cardinals. They were pathetic. They were actually good in Chicago, then they moved to St. Louis, quite bad. Now they've been bad again.
Well, but, I mean, this is quid pro quo of the modern era. I mean, Rooney campaigned for Obama. Franco Harris, I believe, a legend of the Steelers, campaigned for Obama.
Franco Harris, who – the reason I'm a Pittsburgh Steelers fan was because of Franco Harris. When I was a kid, I was a young boy. I was a young child, walked 5 miles each way to school through banks of snow and so on. And my dad died, and I fell in love
God.
With – well,
I'm
sorry, I didn't mean to turn it into a real sad story. My dad had died, and I fell in love with football. And Franco Harris, particularly, who made this catch, the Immaculate Reception, which right. was given its name by this fellow, Myron Cope, who was another Pittsburgh legend. And Franco, I began to have a recurring dream about Franco Harris every night for about 3 or 4 years in my childhood, where he would come to my home, we'd play football. Franco Harris became, in my mind, this messiah figure. And I, therefore, began to follow the team very vigorously. So when my own son was born, unfortunately, he inherited this messianic Steelers gene a bit.
Is his name Franco?
His name is not Franco. It's his Solomon Isaac Franco Dubner. We considered it didn't really have the didn't really flow.
But that's a sweet story.
I did sign
story,
when I was
Steven.
A kid. I signed in elementary school for about 3 years. I signed all my papers Franco Dubner. I was I was deeply and thoroughly obsessed. And then I actually went.
That is such a sweet story.
It wasn't so sweet, really.
Was he kind of a father figure? I mean,
he was very much. In fact, a few years ago, I went back to Pittsburgh and tracked him down and kind of insinuated myself into his life and wrote a book about him and what he became. It was a book called Confessions of a Hero Worshipper. And it was talking about the whole notion of hero worship and how healthy or unhealthy it may be.
Wow. So I guess we have to support the Steelers now because it's you, it's the little boy, Stephen Dubner.
You kind of do.
Missing his dad. And
you kind of do. I bring my son to one game in Pittsburgh every year. The problem is we've gone the three last years and they've lost every game. They've barely lost any games at home in the last 3 years, and we've been at all three of them. So I'm not a good luck charm, unfortunately.
And
that's why we're not going to the Super Bowl.
You're not going to the Super Bowl because you're bad luck.
It takes too long to get to the bathroom.
The practical Stephen Dubner, co-author of the Freakonomics book and blog, and our takeaway contributor who's going to stay with us. And Femi Oke is now with us with the headlines, and suddenly there's a zillion of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Good morning, all. 22 minutes to the top of the hour. A Commerce Department report is out this morning. It shows last fall was the worst quarter in decades, but better than many economists had thought. The gross domestic product shrunk by 3.8%. President Obama is set to strike down several Bush-era executive orders dealing with the workplace. The moves involve workers' rights to unionize and the relationship between federal contractors and labor unions. The president will also create a middle-class task force headed by Vice President Biden, and that group will focus on jobs, education and childcare issues. New reports say that rebuilding in Iraq and Afghanistan is not going well. In Iraq, a U.S. government audit says that $125 billion efforts will face a new trouble this year, even though violence is declining. The audit says that some American contractors could leave because they're no longer immune from Iraqi laws. In Afghanistan, the U.S. Overseer for Reconstruction says there's no coherent strategy to put the country back on its feet. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. He took the opportunity to announce a humanitarian flash appeal for people in Gaza.
With the help of this $613 million appeal, the United Nations and other aid agencies can jump into action.
The UN Secretary General says that the funds are urgently needed to help provide water, sanitation, healthcare and food to Gaza's 1.4 million people. And as free market leaders meet in Davos, a host of left-leaning politicians takes to the stage at the World Social Forum in Brazil.
Is it a parallel sort of Davos thing?
But opposite end of the spectrum.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. So at this social forum, we have Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and Bolivia's Evo Morales. They were cheered there. And it's a direct response to Davos with lots of condemnations of capitalism. And it's estimated that 100,000 people will be attending.
We should ask those people how to name the bad bank.
I think they might have a few suggestions.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Adore you, Doji is away. But Stephen Dubner is here with me. And, sadly, one more layoff reported yesterday.
There are tens of thousands of people across America, just like me, who are losing their jobs or lost their jobs. So I'm not looking for any pity, and I don't need anybody to sympathize or feel bad for me because I'll be just fine.
Rod Blagojevich, no longer governor of Illinois. He was removed from office after impeachment by the Illinois legislature. He says he'll be fine. Hank Shonkoff, political consultant and job coach, is Rod Blagojevich going to be fine?
Well, he'll probably go to jail at some point. He certainly has set himself up pretty good for it.
Doesn't sound fine, then. That doesn't sound...
Not a good way to take a layoff. You know, you get laid off from this job, and then you go to another job, but they don't pay you much. It's called prison.
Ouch. All right, so let's think beyond prison. Does Blagojevich have a talk show consultant, comedy guy, future media, something or other?
I don't think he's got a something or other at all. Look, the guy did everything wrong. He gets locked up on a federal complaint. The wiretap information becomes public knowledge, all the content. He travels the country telling everybody, well, you need to give him a break. He appears he's like the O.J. Simpson of politics, racing in a car, or the car this time is a plane across the nation, appearing on talk shows. I mean, if he had a good defense lawyer, which he probably doesn't, but it told him to shut up and disappear, and he probably wouldn't be impeached today. But he had to remind everybody how much trouble he was in, and by doing so, he recreated the joke that is Illinois politics across the nation.
All right, so it sounds like at the very least he really needs you. Okay, given all that bad stuff, all those bad decisions that you think that he's made, he could still beat the federal rap. I mean, that's what he claims he's going to try to do. What would you advise him to do now?
Well, the damage is pretty significant. You know, it's hard to, after you've put formaldehyde in someone's veins, it's hard to bring them back to life. Were I he, I would disappear. I'd go over to my lawyer. I'd shut up. And I'd conduct a trial and pray that I could win. I mean, I'd be concerned about the jury pool. What he's done with the jury pool in Illinois has made himself appear kind of clownish, and those are the people that are going to decide what happens to him. So if I were him, I would never have done what I did. I would have isolated the incident. I would have appeared to try to be charitable. I would have been a governor who was involved in the minute the cops grabbed me or the feds grabbed me. I would have been more involved in job arguments and tried to protect my friends in the legislature and keep them close, but apparently he didn't have a lot of friends. That's the other thing that's notable.
Hank, this is Stephen Dubner. Will this incident be the ammunition that's needed for, let's say, Russ Feingold, the senator from Wisconsin, who's trying to change the way Senate seats are appointed by governors? Will this be the straw that breaks the camel's back? Will we see the end of appointed senators?
Well, look, it's not so easy to change the Constitution. That's problem one. Could Feingold be the guy to do it? Sure, he's got a record of changing things overall, but the Senate's got to agree, and they're not going to take the governors on in local states. Appointing the senator in a vacancy is a serious piece of power.
All right, but Hank, you know, as much as we deplore the behavior of Rod Blagojevich, as much of it we know through the allegations, I don't want to see this governor appointment drama stuff go away. Do you?
It's
I
kind
love
of great
it.
Theater. It's better than anything on television during the day.
More business for you, though, Hank, if they're not appointed, right?
Look, I think that you cannot take this away from governors. You know why? It's not the federal government's business to do
I
this.
Agree. And we need the theater here in America. We need something like this. Hank Steinkopf, thanks so much. Or Steinkopf, thanks so much for joining us. Political
Thank
consultant talking about Rod Blagojevich's future here on The Takeaway.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with the headlines from Femi Okay.
At 13 minutes to the top of the hour, Iraqis go to the polls tomorrow to vote in local elections. Security is tight around the country, and there has already been violence targeting candidates and killing several of them. A Commerce Department report is out this morning. It shows last fall was the worst quarter in decades, but better than many economists had thought. The gross domestic product shrunk by 3.8%. ExxonMobil shatters a US record with $45.2 billion annual profit, and that's despite the year-end oil plunge. And while we're on the subject of money, a shipwreck worth billions of dollars in treasure has been found off the coast of New England. Greg Brooks' salvaging company found the ship. Have a listen to the description of what's on board.
Our researchers found out that it had 71 point some odd tons of platinum ingots on board, a ton and a half of industrial diamond, 10 tons of gold ingot, and a good possibility, even though we haven't proven this part yet, of a 1 meter square box of gem quality diamonds, with the smallest being 5 carats.
Oh, he's bummed.
Somebody's rich. Now, the ship was sunk during World War II en route from Europe to the US. It's believed it was payment for military supplies. And the booty, if I'm allowed to say that word on radio, is worth around $10 billion.
Some booty call.
A lot of junk in the trunk there.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Femi. So we've been talking about bad banks. If the Fed makes a bad bank to purchase toxic debt from regular banks, what should we call the bank? Stephen sent us this email. It should be called the Statue of Liberty Bank with the motto, "Give me your tired, your poor, your worthless assets, yearning to be free, the wretched refuse of your schemes offshore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden vault door." What's your suggestion? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. So if you're looking at the front page of the New York Times, we've got a couple of stories that we've certainly had questions about. We want to get more information about. We begin in Baghdad, Iraq, with Ian Fisher, who writes that the real test in the upcoming Iraqi elections will be to pay attention to what happens in the city of Mosul in the north of the country. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning.
Why is Mosul so important in your view, and what signs do we have that indicate how important this election is going to be?
Well, most is important. Well, for one big reason, and that is that the violence is still going on. I mean, after the sort of surge and the sort of cooperation from the Sunni tribes, most of Iraq has been relatively quiet, if kind of fragilely. I think people were tired. People are sort of looking toward the future a bit. And what Mosul shows is an election in a place where the emotions and the violence is very raw. So the issue sort of plays itself out politically in that in 2005, the Arab groups boycotted. And so Kurdish groups, who are their sort of are their rivals, picked up 31 out of 41 seats. Now the Arabs are not boycotting. In fact, they're fighting very, very hard. It looks like they're going to win. So it looks like there'll be a much more representative council. Thus, the question is, will a kind of political inclusion reduce the violence with these groups that some of whom may, it's believed, have a political agenda rather than merely a religious one?
Ian, tell me the flavor of this campaign in the sense that the Arab parties have decided to participate. Have they given you a reason why and their sense of confidence going in here?
Well, precisely what I just said. I mean, they boycotted in 2005. After that, an extraordinary amount of violence exploded in Mosul and around the country, but it's persisted in Mosul. And essentially, they say, look, the violence didn't work. Let's participate in these elections, and we will have a council that, again, more accurately reflects the ethnic makeup. So Mosul is probably, I don't know, two-thirds Arab, possibly a third Kurd with other minorities represented. So the argument goes, and some people aren't sure, you know, entirely how true it is, that greater representation equals fairer politics equals less violence.
But I guess what I'm asking is the quality of the sort of violent sectarian rivalry in Mosul reflected in the rhetoric in the campaign? In other words, are they saying, you know, we're going to clobber you, or are they saying we want to join in some sort of dialogue and move forward? You know, that kind of political neutral blah, blah, blah that you hear all the time in the United States.
That's interesting. It's a little bit of both. On one hand, everybody there sort of realizes that for things to work long term, they're going to have to cooperate. The Kurdish groups has pledged to work with one of the two Arab parties. Both of the Arab parties say they'll work with the Kurdish groups. So there is some sense of let's all come together. On the other hand, they are beating themselves up mightily, with each side, you know, taking a sectarian line against the other. The Kurds say that the Arabs are cheating and intimidating and driving people out of Mosul. The Arabs say that the Kurds are trying to sort of make gains in the region between Mosul and the independent enclave of Kurdistan, kind of shoring up their enclave
right.
there.
Quite
so
a mix.
So again, it's a bit of both.
And it's quite a mix, and we'll definitely see the outcome, as early as Saturday, although the results probably won't be in, but the voting will take place on Saturday. Ian Fisher in Baghdad from the New York Times, extending on the story that he's got on the front page this morning. Also on the front page this morning is a bit of a spy novel. Eric Lichbau is here to explain from the New York Times Washington Bureau. He's the author of Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice. Right off the bat, Eric, how can somebody still be a spy if they're in prison?
Well, pretty remarkable story. You wouldn't think they could. In this case, Harold Nicholson, who was one of the more notorious spies from the 1990s, a high-ranking CIA officer, used his son, his 24-year-old son, to allegedly continue spying for the Russians, passing on information that he had gathered before he was in prison, particularly things like counterterrorism detection methods, ways of avoiding capture by Americans, to send his son out and have him meet in spots around the world, from Lima, Peru, to Mexico City, to Cyprus, and collect $35,000 that Nicholson said was his pension from his days as a Russian spy.
Eric, I mean, you've seen a lot of unsealed in federal indictments in your time, but I'm wondering if, when you looked at this one, did it feel bold and outrageous, or a little bit tawdry as you looked at the details?
A little bit of both. I mean, I can't remember reading about a case quite like this, and I talked to a number of espionage experts who described it in words like amazing and unique and unprecedented. The idea that that he was able to and was brazen enough to use his own son and allegedly put him in considerable jeopardy is a sort of straight out of a John le Carré novel. Of course, The trial process will now just begin, and there may be another side to this. The other question is the security measures in place at the prison. The FBI was apparently monitoring and allowing this plot to go on for a period of months and even years. But there are questions as to the standard monitoring of mail and email and communications, and whether or not at an early stage, as far back as 2002, when Nicholson was allegedly trying to use other inmates to get messages out to the Russians, whether or not the proper security was in place.
Stephen Dubner's got your last question, Eric.
Eric, in your piece, he says he did it. He said he spied for the financial security of his kids. What does that say about the salary being paid to these guys?
It's funny. He referred over and over again in this indictment to his pension not from the U.S. government as a 16-year employee of the CIA, but his pension from the Russians. He was making at the CIA, I believe, about $75,000 a year. He had gone through a divorce that left him with some money troubles, and he saw this as his cash cow. He had made in his first career as a spy, had admitted making about $300,000 from the Russians. This time his son collected about $35,000. Not a lot of money by spy standards, but it's strange what motivates people.
Well, but it's not so strange. They come straight out of Le Carré, because so many of the characters in Le Carré were worried about their pensions and were like putting away these nest eggs, and you can see the exact same narrative here, Eric. Thanks so much.
Right. Thanks for having me.
Great story on the front page of the New York Times. Eric Lichtbau is the author of Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice, but his story on a spy continuing to spy for the Russians while in prison is right there in the Times this morning. The Treasury is thinking about creating a so-called bad bank that would buy up all the toxic debt and mortgage securities from the regular banks. What should we call this bank?
Hi, this is Carl Merkin from New York City. I think the bank should be named the Reaganomics Recovery Bank and Mistrust.
Tell us your suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And our takeaway this morning tells you why that bank is so tricky to set up.
Essentially, the government would have to set up a complete separate institution, and it would be on a size and a scale of something like vastly larger than the RTC. We've never actually seen it, and that's part of what's taking so long to figure this out, is how exactly would you do it?
Ooh, that's nasty. Jane Sassine, Washington bureau chief for Businessweek magazine, talking about the intricacies of this new bad bank. We're always on. If you missed anything, take our podcast, subscribe at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. You can hear all of Stephen Dubner, who was with us this hour. Doria Doge is away, and thank you, Stephen, for being with us. I'm John Hockenberry, and of course, this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Fast. fasten your seatbelts. We're going all the way to Pluto. So is Pluto a real planet or just an icy bit of space lint out on the edge of the solar system? The scientist who deposed Pluto from its interplanetary status found how beloved the little guy is. Mythological planets, astrophysical reality, when worlds collide. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, people of planet Earth. It's Friday, January 30th. Adora Udoji is away. The Pittsburgh Steelers are the Super Bowl favorite this weekend. You know that. They're also a favorite team of those who value diversity. We're going to talk about that in a moment. It's a real legacy this weekend. Pluto's biography, the former planet that is, it's an amazing story, and maybe we'll have some more B-52s music. We'll see. First, top headlines. The U.S. economy shrank by 3.8% in the final quarter of last year. It's not good news by any measure, but it's not as bad as many forecasters expected. It's still the worst showing in a quarter century. This might be the headline in the Chicago Sun-Times this morning. No love for Gov. That's how it ended for Rod Blagojevich.
There are 59 senators voting yes and zero senators voting no.
That's some consensus. Illinois Chief Justice Thomas Fitzgerald announcing the vote, ousting Blagojevich. Bipartisanship is apparently alive and well there. Not a single Illinois state senator in either party backed him. The former governor now faces federal corruption charges. Republicans are looking for a roadmap back to power, and this morning party insiders are going to elect a leader. It's been a pretty rough campaign so far. Five men, including the current chairman, are now fighting to head the GOP. Femi Oke is here with some more headlines now.
Hello there, John. Good morning, all. Getting some news in from Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe's main opposition party says that it will join a unity government with long-ruling President Robert Mugabe. Opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai made the announcement after months of fruitless talks and false starts. Most companies are bleeding money in the tough economy, but at least one is still raking it in.
Oh, good.
ExxonMobil.
Oh, I love them.
I thought so. Just announced a profit of more than $45 billion last year, John. That's an all-time high.
That's huge.
For an American company.
And the oil price was plummeting. How did they do that?
That's
amazing. They're smart.
They could teach us all a lesson.
They should.
4 million uninsured children could soon get some health coverage. Last night, the Senate passed a bill to give them government-sponsored insurance, and a cigarette tax hike will help fund the rollout. And the bill goes to the House next.
That's a very important piece of legislation. The S&P starts trading at 8:45. Looks like a volatile day on Wall Street. The GDP number caused the futures market to turn around from negative to positive, then positive to negative. Now it's back in the plus column this morning. The Dow begins at 81.49. Treasury is thinking about creating a bad bank that would buy up toxic debt and mortgage securities. We thought of First National Mistrust, but here's your suggestion.
All right. This is Beth calling from west of Boston, and the name that I would like to give the bad bank is Chump and Dump, Tank and Trust. Thank you very much.
Really good. Tell us your suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. People like bad banks. Femi, what's that all about?
I'm getting used to it.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I stand before you in a very unique and lonely place.
That's Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. At the end, though, he was lonely. 59-0 vote to remove him from office. And no longer unique. The Illinois State Senate ousted Governor Rod Blagojevich last night, barred him from holding public office in the state again. Though the governor showed up at the trial finally to make a closing statement in his own defense, state senators were not convinced, and 59-0, as we mentioned, it was all over. Joining us to discuss it is Amanda Vinicky, State House reporter, Illinois Public Radio, WUIS in Springfield. Amanda, we always knew we'd get to this point, didn't we?
You know, we did. December 9th, as soon as everyone found out that Rod Blagojevich had been arrested, it was pretty clear what sort of end his political career would come to.
It's amazing to me, though, even though this outcome is not unexpected, there were a lot of machinations between. It went here and there. And for a while, Blagojevich actually had convinced some that he could possibly hold out.
Yeah, you know, Rod Blagojevich definitely has a flair for the dramatic, and he really has taken this story on his own account, I think, through a lot of twists and turns. You know, throughout it, we had, of course, I think why this story has received so much attention nationally is because part of the allegations against him are that he supposedly tried to basically auction off the Illinois Senate seat vacated by now President Obama. And then everyone said, no, there's no way that he'll, you know, appoint someone that to seat. And there we go, Roland Burris. He went on all of these national talk shows this whole week saying this Senate trial is unfair and this whole procedure is a sham. And then all of a sudden showed up yesterday to make this kind of crown glory passionate speech at the end. So in every way, he's been very Rod Blagojevich, most of those who've been following him would say.
He stayed in character. Well, let's talk about the speech yesterday. I mean, at one point he compared his impeachment, or he created a logic that he was being impeached somehow for advocating for low-cost prescription drugs from Canada, and then he began to rope all the other legislators in America who advocated that position, and he was talking about impeaching everybody who'd ever espoused any of the positions he'd espoused, and the list sort of reached its climax right here. Take a listen.
And while we're at it, let's go reach right into the United States Senate and let's expel John McCain and Ted Kennedy, because I worked with them on this issue of the reimportation of prescription drugs. And then let's not stop there. Let's demand that President Obama fire Rahm Emanuel, because Rahm Emanuel was the one who gave me this idea.
Now, I've been checking the wires all morning. It seems as though Rahm Emanuel still has his job, and McCain and Kennedy are still in the Senate. Give us a sense of the argument that Blagojevich tried to lay out yesterday.
Well, really, it's surprising that tactic didn't work. No, I'm just kidding. I think that pretty much all that Blagojevich was trying to do, several things. First of all, he mentioned not only those names, but he said, you know, in pointing and speaking to the Illinois Senate, looked over at the Democratic side of the chambers and said, and I couldn't have done it without you. And I really do think that he feels that way. And in that sense, he's right. There are a lot of people, and the Senate Democrats in particular, have been his ally throughout and helped him with a lot of these initiatives. So that was true. I think that an element of this, however, is kind of trying to drag other people down with him. And I think that in his mind, and I unfortunately have not had the chance to, you know, personally ask him this, but those that know him well and are confidants say, you know, he really does have this sort of attitude that he is one who is being picked on, and for no particular reason, he doesn't understand why he has been cast in this type of judgment when, as he sees it, all of these other politicians really have been doing the same thing.
You know, the other logic, an argument he tried to present, which seemed ironic to me, given that he spent much of his time this week on, you know, like the Today Show or Good Morning America or The View or whatever the morning shows that he was on, including, I guess, Larry King he was on at one point. He said that somehow he'd never really got his day in court. Amanda, listen to this.
I think fundamental fairness, fundamental justice, natural law, and constitutional rights suggest I should be able to bring witnesses in to say I didn't do the things they said I did.
So he claims that he wasn't able to present witnesses, which certainly didn't make Illinois State Senator Kwame Raoul happy. This was his response.
Our rules provided him the opportunity to present witnesses. And I'd like to remind everybody, as Senator Hayne did before me, that closing arguments are not evidence. The governor presented absolutely no evidence in this case.
So, you know, evaluate those two statements. And I'm wondering if behind it all, Blagojevich is saving his powder for the much tougher battle with the federal court.
I think that that's very true, that for Rod Blagojevich to have taken the witness stand during the Senate trial would have been against any advice that any lawyer worth his or her salt would have advised against, in the sense that if he's up there sworn and taking an oath in the Senate trial, who knows what he may be asked, and who knows what therefore could be used against him if, and as this is obviously expected to do, the criminal complaint against him eventually becomes an indictment and then goes to trial. So there is that. But in terms of the witnesses, yes, he could have called witnesses. The only witnesses that he wasn't allowed to call were those that the U.S. Attorney's Office had said no, that would interfere with our criminal investigation. And in that regard, that was the same situation for the House prosecutor. So it was this argument that he tried to make. And again, it seems as if he truly feels within his own heart and within his own mind, but one that did not buy him any winnings with the Illinois State Senate and the senators. And also, I do think may have won some public opinion, however. I do think that there were some people swayed.
Well, let's talk about the swaying in just a moment. But you know, I get the impression from these two statements that, you know, Rod Blagojevich has his own view of reality. And, you know, if as you say, by advice of counsel, he probably didn't present any witnesses because it would help his case, but he certainly wasn't prohibited from doing so. Why does he stand up and say things that are just on the face of them patently false?
You know, that's a question that a lot of people have been asking throughout the governor's 6 years in office. I mean, this sort of action by the governor is really not very common. He has been known to just ignore questions on its face and kind of go off on a tangent and saying, you know, for instance, this healthcare program that he's talked so much about and says he provided children with healthcare that wouldn't otherwise have it. And yet the state supposedly has no paperwork to show what children are actually getting this, how many individuals that includes, how much money it's costing. And yet he continually says, you know, I've done it. And he has this whole stump speech about it. You know, that is, again, very Governor Blagojevich. And I do think that it puts us as reporters in kind of this interesting situation when you have the governor of a state saying something. Do you ignore it, and what do you do when it clearly flies in the face of the facts and the reality, and yet he continues to repeat it and say it, as do the individuals who work for him as spokespeople?
You mentioned that you know, some people maybe were swayed yesterday. I guess if we're thinking about the people of Illinois, and not that you would want to speak for all of them today, but in general, as people wake up this morning, is the feeling, let's just forget this guy and move on, or is he a folk hero in some quarters?
You know, I'm sure that he has some backers. For instance, he has been a staunch supporter of healthcare, and so you have some healthcare advocates just saying that, maybe not fully sticking up for him, but nonetheless saying that, hey, he hasn't done all bad things. And he won a lot of public support in his move to offer free rides to seniors on public transit, things such as that. However, I think largely the mood in Illinois is one of a big sigh of relief that this is over with, looking forward and hopeful to the future and Illinois' new governor now, Pat Quinn. And also, I think, I mean, jubilation. I think that you saw in state offices here yesterday probably some champagne being a drink on the sly and some parties out at the bars, at least in the capital city here, and truly people that were happy because Blagojevich has not won many friends throughout those 6 years in office.
Champagne on the sly, that would be unusual in Illinois. So it launched Roland Burris's career. It actually launched your sort of national profile here on The Takeaway, Amanda. We're asking people about this bad bank that the feds, before you go, are thinking about creating for all the toxic assets. I don't know if we're going to talk to you again soon. I don't know how many governor impeachments happen in one single career. You got a name for the bank for us?
Why don't we go with the bank to buy up the last kid picked in gym class type of assets. How's that?
Okay. Last Kid National Bank. Amanda Vinicky.
There we go.
State House reporter, Illinois Public Radio, has been with us on this long, strange Blagojevich trip from Springfield, Illinois. Thanks, Amanda.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. A lot of pre-market volatility as the economy digests some numbers we're going to talk about in just a moment. But we want to ask you about this so-called bad bank that the Treasury is thinking of setting up that's going to buy toxic debt and mortgage securities from the regular banks. I mean, at the very least, it's going to need a name, right?
This is Terry from Tacoma. And when I woke up this morning, the first thing that popped into my mind was Bank of Shame. Bank of Shame of America.
Nice. Tell us your suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. So within the hour, we learned that the GDP, the most complete measure of economic performance in the U.S. economy, possibly shrank at an annual rate of 3.8% in the fourth quarter of 2008. Now, the market responded positively because it wasn't as bad as investors predicted. But as the numbers got digested over and over, we've been bouncing around on Wall Street in advance of trading. The contraction was significantly better than many economists had expected. But listen, it's a shrinking at the fastest pace in 26 years for the quarter. Joining us now is John Authors, investment editor for the Financial Times. He joins us here from New York. John, thanks for being part of the program. And, you know, 3.8% decline, an awful number in any climate, but it still is relatively positive based on what people were thinking.
Well, people were expecting 5.5%, which would have been truly terrible. And because we'd had so many very negative numbers in the last few days, I think people in their, you know, traders in their heart of hearts thought that it might have been worse than that still. However, I mean, that's why you saw markets bounce a bit when the announcement came out, because it really was terrible, though the number was. It was actually a very positive surprise.
Right.
The problem is that people are now beginning to look more closely at the numbers. I mean, it's a huge economic release, obviously, and it's becoming obvious that in many ways the reason we didn't get a bigger slowdown in the last quarter is simply because companies couldn't cut fast enough. So we actually had a considerable growth in unsold inventories, and that would then imply that as they couldn't production quickly enough, that would explain why we're now getting all these rather scary news of layoffs so far in the last few weeks. And then again, there are some really ugly numbers once you start beginning to look down at it. So expenditure on equipment and software, which is sort of fairly good measure of how the basics of how big a company expects itself to be, went down 27.8%.
Yeah, it seems that the NASDAQ particularly is digesting that number, because the NASDAQ popped the most on the futures and then went all the way in the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. And there you're talking about investments that would have a multiplier effect over many quarters, and that kind of a decline means business is going to fall off the cliff in the next quarter in certain sectors. Which ones?
Any sector that actually provides the inventory buildup is a problem primarily for the manufacturing sectors that make stuff, and it could be a problem for high tech, which people have begun to talk about as the kind of sector that was relatively recession resistant. But obviously, the fewer people that are actually working, the more layoffs you get, the fewer computer terminals that are being used. So in terms of what's particularly ugly from this data, those are the sectors that you would feel most uncomfortable about. So it's not surprising if the NASDAQ's hurting more than others at the moment.
But it's probably misleading to simply look at the effect on computer software makers, et cetera, of that 25% decline, because really it's the psychological dimension that maybe is the most powerful in that businesses are basically saying, we're shutting whole divisions down.
And we're not doing so fast enough.
Right.
Because we've still got inventory piling up. Yes, exactly. Snap reports I saw of this suggested that in many ways they borrowed from the quarter that we're now in effect, that we may have had less of a terrible outcome in the fourth quarter than we were expecting, but that will be directly transferred to the first quarter of this year.
Huh. How is the U.S. economy doing based on similar reports of economic output, say, in the Eurozone or in the U.K. or over in East Asia?
Well, it varies according primarily to how dependent on exports you are and how dependent you are on financial services. So countries like my home country, Britain, which is particularly dependent on financial services, seems to be, if anything, in even worse shape than the States. Countries that are particularly dependent on exports, perhaps the best example would be South Korea. Are again probably in even worse shape. They make a lot of their money by providing components to China to assemble. And you are also seeing a very sharp slowdown in Europe, which had taken, perhaps more importantly, had taken politicians by surprise. There, they hadn't expected things to get this bad this quickly. There are slight variations. Broadly speaking, this is. In the modern era since the war, this is the most truly global recession there has been.
Wow. Well, John, can I put you on the spot for 2 seconds?
You can put me on the spot.
We've been trying to name this bad bank that the feds are claiming they're going to possibly set up for toxic assets. Got a name for it?
Not one that you would want to broadcast. I have seen traders coming up with a rhyme for Citicorp.
Okay, that we
or
can't broadcast.
Bank that might work quite well, but I don't think I'm going to tell you, explain
right.
that for you
but,
on the
But
air.
We can't broadcast, yes, because this is a family show. John Authors, investment editor for the Financial Times, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Oh, that's great. Femi OK has the headlines.
Hi there. John would probably get the rhyming slang of the banker's bank as well. 28 minutes past the hour. Later this morning, President Obama will overturn several Bush-era executive orders. The moves involve workers' rights to unionize and the relationship between federal contractors and labor unions. The Obama administration will also launch a middle-class task force to work on education, jobs, and other issues affecting the middle class, and Vice President Biden will head it. Pat Quinn is starting his first full day on the job as governor of Illinois. He was sworn in yesterday after Rob Blagojevich was ousted by the state Senate. The economy shrank 3.8% at the end of 2008. That's the worst showing in a quarter of a century. The Commerce Department released the numbers last hour, and they are slightly better than economists predicted. Zimbabwe's main opposition party will join a unity government early next month. The party's leader announced the move today. Talks between President Robert Mugabe's long-ruling government and the opposition have gone in fits and starts for months. And meanwhile, the cholera epidemic in Zimbabwe is getting worse. The United Nations says that 60,000 people have the disease, and that makes it the deadliest outbreak in Africa in 15 years. That's a look at stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We've been talking all morning about how the Treasury is considering making a bad bank that's going to purchase toxic debt from regular banks. Well, it may be a bad idea, it may be a good idea, but whatever it is, it's probably going to have $100 billion of taxpayer assets, and it needs a name, right? We've had some posts because we're looking for suggestions for the name of this bank. Raphael suggests Savior Bank. Janet recommends the George W. Bush National Bank. Tell us your ideas at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. That Bush comment suggests that the approval ratings for the outgoing president makes it irresistible to think of the transition to the Obama administration as something of a turning of a historical page. And of course, President Obama has been compared to all kinds of American leaders, from Abraham Lincoln to John F. Kennedy. But Matt Bai, who joins us, he's a New York Times Magazine contributing writer, suggests a little bit of caution here, and that looking back at history for parallels is maybe perilous here. You fail to look forward when you do that. We're on the line now with Matt Bai. He's the author of Don't Look Back, an article that explores this issue in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Matt Bai, good morning.
Hey, John, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
I want to know if they're going to bury the bad debt at Yucca Mountain. That's my
nice
question about this.
The Nuke Bank, the Nuke Waste National Bank.
Right.
Or the Yucca National Bank. That's a great suggestion, Matt.
If it's toxic, you got to put it somewhere.
There you go. You got to get the people of Nevada to go along with it, though, and that's the problem. maybe Tim Geithner can work on that. Why not look to history to see parallels for Barack Obama in many ways, and the rhetoric of the campaign and the transition made those historical comparisons kind of irresistible?
Well, it's okay to look to history. I mean, I would be the world's largest hypocrite if I said it wasn't, because I've written so many pieces. I mean, we need history. Everybody, it's an important frame of reference. And you can look at Obama, as I point out, a lot of different ways. I mean, he himself made clear comparisons with Abraham Lincoln in his inauguration lineup. You know, I've compared him, and have many others, to John Kennedy in so many ways: a young senator, an outsider, a generational change. And of course, there are a lot of comparisons now to Franklin Roosevelt. I think where you get into trouble is where you begin to look so hard backward, where you begin to draw such comparisons where they're a little bit forced, that it begins to go beyond looking at certain parallels, and you begin to think that you're living in a very close resemblance of another time, and that you can actually solve your problems the way they were solved in another time. And I think people get stuck on historical comparisons because they're just looking for a blueprint, and it's the easiest way to get one, or because it's an easy way to argue for what you want, right? If Obama is FDR, then it follows you should get a New Deal, and there are an awful lot of people out there who think, you know, all we need is another New Deal. But I think we ought not to use history as a cover for not trying to understand, explain, and grapple with our own very difficult time.
You suggest that a comparison at least as useful as FDR or John F. Kennedy might be Ronald Reagan. And I was thinking about that this morning. And it seems to me the Reagan issue, as successful of a leader as Ronald Reagan was, it was also the case that America, in some sense, got together and created this consensus that something new had to happen now. And so then it did. And so in many ways, Reagan was kind of surfing the edge of a wave that already existed. I'm wondering if that's the sort of Obama scenario that you're looking at when you look at Reagan.
I think you're exactly right, John. You really are. First of all, the point, if you really want to make historical comparisons based on the external situation in the country, not the White House, Reagan is as good a comparison probably as the Great, certainly better than the Great Depression, and as good as Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, if you look at the economic situation he faced, and the soaring interest rates and the soaring inflation, it was a little different. But you know, you're reading an awful lot in the paper about, you know, since 1981, it's the worst since 1981. I mean, we forget how terrible and how scary and terrible an economic period that was, and an international period. So there are a lot of comparisons. But you know, you put your finger on it. I think, you know, Reagan was the product of a moment where people felt very badly about the country and its direction, and wanted strong leadership to change it. And what he did, I think, to fill that vacuum was to explain it, was really to offer people a story of how the excesses of government and the weakness of a government that got you there, and how you were going to get out. And, of course, we still debate today whether that story was an accurate one, and that's part of politics. But I think Obama, you know, certainly tried to do that in his inauguration speech, and has tried to do that all through the transition and in the campaign, is to give people not just to arrive on the scene, but to give people some sense of how you got there. In his telling, we had a generation of leadership that failed to make difficult choices, right? That couldn't put away childish things, as he put it. He wasn't talking about just the president, Bush. He was talking about a whole generation. And in that sense, he is beginning to tell that story.
But he was also talking about, and this is what's difficult about the story, about the private sector being the place that has failed us, and that in many ways it's the government that is the hero, exactly the opposite of what Ronald Reagan's story is. How quickly do you think people are going to come to that story, and what's going to need to happen for people to have faith in government after really a generation of trashing government as a way to get into office?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I don't know how quickly people will come to it. But I personally, there's a million interpretations of this. I think what has to happen is you need to be sort of honest about this. I mean, if you want to talk about making hard choices as a country, then you have to give the country difficult choices, and I think you have to have an honest discussion. And what disappointed me about this stimulus process, you know, everybody has complaints about this bill or the way it was done. What disappointed me is that I think there's a lot of things going on in that bill that are actually different. Entitlement and tax reform, long-term investment, short-term stimulus. Those are different stories that need to be explained to people. And I think my fear is that you don't explain all those different stories. You decide it's just more expedient, more possible to do it all at once when you have a blank check. It doesn't work exactly the way people want, perhaps, or in the short term. And you're sort of stuck looking like government as usual, right? Throwing money at a problem and not fixing it. I think he has to be very conscious along the way of explaining to the public things that, you know, of explaining exactly how we got here and how he plans to get us out.
Well, that certainly is the story. And we should remind our listeners that Ronald Reagan had a opposition Congress in his first term, unlike what Barack Obama has. So,
but he also had an assassination attempt, which, you know, perversely helped his political capital quite a bit.
Great point. Matt Bai, New York Times Magazine, contributing writer. Don't Look Back is his article in this Sunday's magazine. Is it too early to compare Barack Obama to big historical figures? Read the article and you can decide. Femi Oke now with the headlines.
At 20 minutes to the top of the hour, Republicans are looking for a new leader to head the party. Party insiders will elect a chairman today. There are five candidates left for the job, including the current chairman, Mike Duncan. New reports say that rebuilding in Iraq and Afghanistan is not going well. In Iraq, a U.S. government audit says that $125 billion efforts will face new trouble this year, even as violence declines. Rafael Nadal will play Switzerland's Roger Federer in the men's finals at the Australian Open this weekend.
It's a rematch.
Nadal beat countryman Fernando Verdasco today, 3-2. Serena Williams and Venus Williams won the women's doubles earlier today. And Williams, that's Venus, will take on Russia's Dinara Safina tomorrow in the women's finals. That's a look at some of the stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is away. The drama continues in Sri Lanka, and I'm grateful we have time to check in on this important story. There's a civil war going on there. The Sri Lankan army presses ahead with its attack against the Tamil Tigers. And in this bizarre twist, the Red Cross says an estimated 250,000 civilians are hemmed in a small rebel-held territory in Sri Lanka's northeast. It's being called a hostage situation. Somini Sengupta, the New Delhi bureau chief for the New York Times joins us. Somini, hostage situation for 250,000 people, is that reasonable?
Yeah, it's completely, a hidden war, if you will. There are 250,000 people who are estimated to be trapped behind the front line. They have been steadily moving. You know, some of them have moved probably 7, 10, 12 times. We don't know, as the military has advanced into Tamil Tiger rebel territory, and the civilians have kind of been pushed along with them, and now they're trapped in this very, very small corner. Now, none of us really know what what's going on there because there isn't any access to independent journalists, to aid agencies. But it does appear as though they have been forbidden from leaving by the LTTE, the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, as they call themselves, which is why they're still behind the front line.
You know, we should remind people that in some sense Sri Lanka is more inaccessible even than Myanmar, Burma, in that the reputation of brutality against journalists is overwhelming in this area, and so really it is very uncovered. What's the state of the conflict between the parties, the Tamil Tigers and the Sri Lankan army at this point, and can you sketch out the context of why this fighting has exploded in the last few weeks?
The Tamil Tigers have been fighting for a quarter of a century for their own ethnic homeland. They did, in fact, rule sort of a de facto state of their own for many years. But in the last couple of years, you've seen renewed fighting between the Sri Lankan military and the Tamil Tigers. And there's no question that the military has had some spectacular successes. And especially in the last couple of months, they have just steadily been driving the Tamil Tigers further and further into a small northeastern corner. Over the weekend, the last Tamil Tiger held major town, what used to be their garrison, and I have been there. It's a town called Mulai Tibu on the northeastern coast.
Mm-hmm.
They seized that over the weekend, and that's when there was apparently a lot of artillery attacks back and forth. The allegation is that many civilians were hurt in those artillery attacks. They are now stuck in makeshift hospitals, and the Red Cross has said this week that that those hospitals are overflowing.
Wow.
They just don't have the medical supplies to even deal with the wounded.
Well, to deal with that situation and quickly, the quarter of a million that we referred to at the top of this segment, does the international community have any options here before we go?
Well, there's been a lot of pressure from all corners, but you know, that hasn't necessarily yielded in any concrete results.
And pressure is all that we can hope for at this point. So Mini Sengupta, New Delhi bureau chief for The New York Times, thanks for joining us from New Delhi, where she's watching the situation in Sri Lanka, where the Red Cross says an estimated quarter of a million civilians are in essentially a hostage situation behind front lines.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with Femi Oke's last look at the headlines for the morning.
Thank you. At 13 minutes to the top of the hour. The Commerce Department says the economy shrank by 3.8% in the fourth quarter of last year. It is the worst decline in decades, but not as nearly as bad as some economists have predicted. ExxonMobil has posted the largest profits by an American company. The oil giant made more than $45 billion last year, and ExxonMobil held the profit record that it has just shattered. 4 million uninsured children could soon get some health coverage. Last night, the Senate passed a bill to give them government-sponsored insurance. And a cigarette tax hike will help fund the rollout. And the bill goes to the House next. Former President Bush twice vetoed similar bills. And heavy security is being imposed in Iraq ahead of Saturday's provincial elections. The polls are being seen as a new test of the country's fragile recovery. And that's a look at some of the stories making news this morning, John.
Thank you, Femi. So we're on our way to Pluto. Fasten your seatbelts, Femi. That includes you. Here in the studio is Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's an astrophysicist, director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History, just uptown here in Manhattan. He's the author of a new book called The Pluto Files, The Rise and Fall of America's Favorite Planet. I should say you're also the host of Nova Science Now on PBS, which is a production of our partner WGBH right up there in Boston. Neil, your book, The Pluto Files, I didn't really know what to expect. I was thinking, oh, this astrophysicist is going to talk about some arcane business because he's trying to get a grant. Who knows? But this is such a personal story about how you decided, based on valid astrophysical evidence, to downgrade Pluto's status in the exhibits at the Rose Center. And the outcry that happened tells a story of culture, of astrophysical mythology and science that you put all in this book, The Pluto Files. It's a great read and an amazing story.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I was in the middle of it. In fact, writing it was catharsis for me because all of these, you know, after we put up that exhibit and Pluto was sort of reorganized in a way unfamiliar to people's elementary school training
right.
about how the solar system should look. There was Pluto. We grouped it with other icy bodies in the outer solar system, and that made a page one story of the New York Times where it said, Pluto not a planet, only in New York. And that's when the hate mail started coming to my office.
And it wasn't the hate mail from physicists.
Well, there was a little bit of that, but the most disgruntled among the letters was from third graders and others from elementary school that had just learned the nine planets.
And for someone who is the head of the Rose Center at the American Museum of Natural History, third graders, that's your demo, dude. Right? You can't be angry in the third graders.
So there they were, just pouring out their feelings and their thoughts on this decision. And this went on for years and years and years. And what was fascinating to me was the extent to which people just chose up sides and started, you know, fighting about it with each other on blogs. And then my name would be brought in and dragged mm-hmm. through the mud. But then, you know, then praised by some who said, look, right. get over it. You know, the science is pushing forward.
The irony here, of course, and there's so many wonderful ironies in this story that I want to get into, is that a little girl was the one who suggested the name Pluto back when Percival Lowell at the Lowell Observatory it was discovered at the Lowell Observatory in 1930.
Indeed, Lowell was of the moneyed Lowells from New England.
That's right.
Went to Arizona,
yep.
built an observatory on a mountaintop, called it, of course, the Lowell Observatory.
Well, there you go.
And he died before the search for the famous Planet X of the day was completed. Clyde Tombaugh
right.
was the one, 24-year-old Midwestern farm boy, amateur astronomer, came in, did a brilliant systematic survey of the night sky, found Pluto, and was named by an 11-year-old girl in England. And who was very well connected.
Right.
Her father was like head of the Cambridge Library, friends with Astronomer Royale. And she had just learned about mythology and that Pluto was the god of the dark, distant underworld.
Now, Neptune, Uranus, Pluto in some sense was a natural for the next planet. But for people in the United States, the connotation of Pluto back in the 1930s didn't have much to do with astrophysics.
No, not at all.
What was it?
Yeah, in the 1920s, there was a widely advertised mineral laxative called Pluto Water with the slogan, when nature won't, Pluto will. So nobody in America is thinking, let's name this thing Pluto. That would create laughter among anyone listening.
So the fact that Pluto was downgraded, you know, in your era, gave an indication of just how far up the mountain Pluto had climbed and just how outraged people were that it was going to be downgraded. Tell us some of the science of the downgrading and why the International Astrophysical Union, I believe, eventually confirmed your decision.
Yeah, well, Pluto is just odd in every measurable way. There's seven moons in the solar system bigger than Pluto, so it's the smallest. It's mostly made of ice by volume, so heat from the sun would evaporate it if it got close, like Earth distance to the sun. It would grow a tail. Mm-hmm. And, that, you know, what kind of behavior is that for a planet? That's just misbehaving.
It's more like lint than a planet, really.
And its orbit is so elongated that it actually crosses the orbit of Neptune. No other planet crosses anybody else's orbit. And the orbit is tipped out of the plane of the solar system.
All right, but the third grader in me wants to say, yeah, but it has a moon.
That's right. So do some asteroids.
All right.
Yeah,
oh,
so,
sorry.
Yeah, well, there you go. So you add up all the data and you find out that actually Pluto is an odd planet but a very well-behaved version of its new species that have been discovered for it. These other bodies in the outer solar system discovered in the 1990s and continuing to this day, they all have weird orbits tipped out of the plane. They're made mostly of ice. And so really, Pluto, rather than being an odd planet, is a very normal-looking frozen body in the outer solar system, hence our reorganization of it.
The first observed member of a family of objects that are way out there, including this thing, the Oort cloud, I believe.
Well, Oort cloud is yet another sort of family, right. even farther out. So this one we call the Kuiper Belt, named for an astronomer at mid-century, Gerard Kuiper, a theorist who predicted there'd be this reservoir of icy bodies in the outer solar system left over from the formation, never got gravitationally vacuumed up by a planet because there's no big planet out there.
So, well, this book is an exploration of what Pluto means and the science of how it was discovered and how it was eventually placed into context. And, of course, it's not an unusual story. Lots of objects in the heavens had very different kinds of contexts as we understood science better and better and better. But what I'm most interested in is your relationship with the third graders. Has that improved?
Yes, it has. Thanks for asking. Oh, by the way, I think third graders were linked to it because of the dog. That's about when you start playing with Disney characters. The dog.
Right.
The dog, Mickey's
Pluto. Yep.
Dog.
I got it.
Pluto. Because you go to Europe, kids don't care. Adults don't care. It's only in America did they care on this level. So I blame Disney for it all, first of all.
And Disney named Pluto as an afterthought. It was kind of a catchy name.
Disney first sketched the dog in 1930. So the dog and the cosmic object have the same tenure in the hearts and minds of Americans.
That's interesting.
This is part of the complication here. So the third graders back then were angry. Third graders today are much more consoling because they were born into the era of Pluto as a reorganized object. And so my letters from third graders today are a little more sort of understanding and accepting.
To Plutophiles young and old, this book is dedicated to, and it begins with this letter, which I'm gonna butcher, but I cannot resist reading it. It's dated 3/26/08, just about a year ago. Dear Dr. Neil Tyson deGrasse, at first, remember all of those kids that sent you bad letters? Well, I want to apologize. All the things that we were wrong about, we're sorry about giving you mean letters, saying we love Pluto but hate you. I'm very sorry. It'll be okay. Taylor, age 7. I mean, get out.
Yeah. It's totally, and it's the cutest thing. And whilst many letters I've transcribed, there's some letters that we scanned in because they're scrawled in crayon and you just feel the kid trying to communicate. And it wasn't just the kids. There were grown-ups and professionals who chose sides as well. And we have their correspondence captured there.
Well, it's certainly one of the great saves in astrophysical history, your career here with the third graders. And it's chronicled in the Pluto Files. Neil deGrasse Tyson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Neil deGrasse Tyson is the host of Nova Science Now on PBS, a production of WGBH, our partners up there in Boston, and the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History right here in New York. The Treasury is thinking about creating a so-called bad bank that would buy up all the toxic debt and mortgage securities from the regular bank. I mean, we want to know, good idea, bad idea, what should we call this bank?
What about bad bank and beyond?
First U.S. bailout bank.
The Reaganomics Recovery Bank and Mistrust.
Oh, that's the bad bank and beyond. Is that what he said? That's great. Tell us your suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. You can actually vote for your favorite on our website. We have this poll up. Tied for number one is First National Distrust and Chump and Dump Tank and Trust. Vote early. I like bank. What was it? Bank? Bad bank and beyond. That's brilliant. I love you guys. This is so great. And here's your takeaway. Of course, it comes from the land of Illinois.
When you have the governor of a state saying something, do you ignore it? And what do you do when it clearly flies in the face of the facts and the reality, and yet he continues to repeat it and say it, as do the individuals who work for him as spokespeople?
That's, of course, Amanda Vinicky, State House reporter for Illinois Public Radio, WIS. We'll miss covering the Blagojevich story with her, although she insists that Blagojevich is not going anywhere. Adoria Doji is away. I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.